This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome to Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frueling. Today we have part two of our discussion about the free will and determinism debate in Star Trek, as seen through that prism, as we examine different types of free will in the Star Trek universe and how Star Trek responds to different types of deterministic factors that we covered last week in Metatrex Episode 1. We launched Episode 1, Zachary. What do you think?
Mike, I can't believe it. It seems like just yesterday we were recording episode one. And of course, listeners don't really know this until right now when I'm going to tell them that we're recording this on the day that episode one actually launched. So today we're listening to ourselves and seeing all of our listeners' comments on the Babel conference. It's very exciting to be here doing episode two after seeing the enthusiasm for our last episode.
It's very encouraging. I'm blown away by the response, the comments from the listeners. We really appreciate everyone who has taken the time to put a comment up in the Babel conference telling us that they enjoyed Metatrex episode one. So thank you so much for that. It was a welcome surprise today to wake up and see that Christopher had gotten us out of space dock, you know, and here we are. And that we've had this, this great response and feedback already. It's just incredibly encouraging.
You know, it's always a little nerve-wracking to launch a new an episode of any podcast, much less a brand new show on Trek FM. And I was just really encouraged by all the positive feedback. You know, we've put so much of ourselves into this over the last few months. And, so like I said last time, Star Trek and philosophy are near and dear to my heart. So I am just thrilled that people are excited to be listening to our show. And I hope we can continue to keep bringing fascinating discussions, things we haven't even thought of yet to Trek FM. And again, I just want to, before we get started on today's episode, I want to remind the listeners that this, you know, philosophy is never a one-way conversation. You know, these are open questions for a reason, and there's different views and theories, and we want to hear everyone's thoughts. So this is just a quick plug for the Babel conference, Trek FM's listeners group. If you go to Facebook and type in Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, you can find Trek FM's listener group, the Babel conference. It'll come right up in the Facebook search bar. Please join the discussion. You know, if you have any reflections or thoughts or comments on anything we talk about during this conversation, if you have any ideas for any topics we could cover next time, let us know and we'll be sure to get things on the calendar. We really want to hear your thoughts. We definitely don't want to make this a one-sided conversation.
Yeah, somebody had said out there that they weren't necessarily up on the terminology. And I just say to that, you don't have to know the terminologies, just be part of the discussion.
Yeah, I am always happy to put my philosophy teacher hat back on and answer any questions. You know, it's almost too easy for me to drop terminology when we talk about philosophy. You know, we're trying to tell philosophy in terms of Star Trek, so I'm trying to avoid, really cryptic philosophical terminology. But, you know, if we happen to use a term or a word or a name of a theory that is a little cryptic, or we brush by anything you want a little more detail on, don't be afraid to find us on Twitter or on the Trek FM's user group, the Babel Conference, and we'll happily give more information and keep the discussion going with you.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. Well, I'm really digging the new podcast smell. So what do you say, Zachary, we dive in and take our listeners on the rest of this journey through this debate of free will and determinism?
Okay, let's do it. So I thought we could start this week by just a really, really quick recap of what we talked about last week. So remember, this is a two-part discussion. Last time we talked about different types of determinism in Star Trek, different types of causal factors that might limit or constrain a person's free will. And we talked about biological determinism, which is just the view that, that your actions might be controlled by your biology, your genes, or your DNA. We talked about physical determinism, which is just the idea that, that all actions might be controlled by laws of nature that are deterministic and outside of your control, prior chains of causes and effects. We talked about cultural determinism, which is the idea that your actions are shaped by cultural or social factors that are outside of your control. Evolutionary determinism, which is just the idea that the human actions are the result of evolutionary processes, millions of years of evolutionary processes that lead up to your actions being instinctive behaviors based on your evolutionary history. We talked about historical determinism, which is the idea that the chain of events in history are sort of controlled by large-scale historical events that, that are outside of your control. We're talking about the Pearl Harbors and the September 11th, these very massive historical events that, that are not within your control. And we talked about the issue of whether history is progressive or not, leading towards something. We talked about psychological determinism, the idea that your actions might be controlled by subconscious psychological factors or emotional states, things that you can't necessarily control. And finally, we talked about theological determinism, the idea that world history or events might be influenced by something in the divine, prophecies or theological impulses, actions of God, miracles, things along that along those lines. So given all of that, the question of the day is, what room is there left over for free will? In what sense can we say human actions, and because we're talking about Star Trek, we're talking about any sentient being's actions. We're talking about androids and alien races you encounter in Star Trek. In what sense are characters in the Star Trek universe, in what sense are their actions free or freely chosen? In what sense do they have personal agency, given the myriad types of deterministic causal factors that seem to control or fully determine their behavior?
Probably should also mention, too, that we discovered last week that Data was fully functional and programmed in multiple techniques.
And of course, the question is, you know, can he program some new techniques for himself, right? This, this is the question of whether Data is autonomous and can he rise above his programming, right? So I guess if we're talking about whether Data is fully functional, the question is, you know, can he program some new techniques for himself and rise above that programming?
Well, if we're talking about Data, I'm not so sure. Now, the doctor can definitely expand his programming, and did. So there you go. So there are a few things to talk about when we talk about free will, or as we refer to it, personal agency. And the first one I think we want to jump into, Zachary, is what sometimes is referred to by its acronym, PAP, or the Principle of Alternate Possibilities. You know, in order for us to exist, in order for free will rather to exist, you know, the reality must allow for more than one possible outcome. There needs to be, in order for this to exist, the idea that, you know, whether you go through door number one, door number two, or door number three, there should be something different behind each of those doors. This idea, I think, was pretty controversial in the 1960s when I think it was Harry Frankfurt, you know, defined this really infamously, that a person is morally responsible for what he's done only if he could have had another choice or done otherwise. So the proverbial gauntlet gets thrown down here in this argument between determinism and particularly, I think, what the actualist movement here, where determinism says, you know, there can only be one possible actual outcome. So, you know, something in the Star Trek universe that I think probably points to this as any one of the Mirror Universe episodes. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the principle of alternate possibilities is kind of a tricky idea to get across. You know, as you start thinking about what free will might mean, given those different types of causal factors that we talked about in episode one, You have to start asking what conditions are necessary or sufficient for free will to exist. And so the principle of alternate possibilities sounds to me like it's a necessary condition for free will, right? If reality isn't set up in such a way that there's more than one possible outcome, right? And of course, I want to tell the story using a Star Trek example. So if I'm in the captain's chair and it's not a real possibility that I could change my course, right? If I don't genuinely have the choice to warp to Ryza or warp to Romulus, right? If either one of those aren't possible outcomes, if there's only one sort of deterministic path that I could be on, it really doesn't make sense to call that free will. And if you try to sort of tell that story in terms of free will, right? If you say there's only one possible course of outcome, but I still have free will in some way, and we are going to talk about this when we talk about compatibilism, the view that free will and determinism are compatible, or that they can both be true in the same time. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But in my mind, my intuition has always been that, look, if reality just isn't set up in such a way that there's more than one possible outcome, it doesn't really make sense to call any action free. So the principle of alternate possibilities is a way of sort of laying down this metaphysical foundation for free will, right? If this basic condition isn't met, that there's more than one possible outcome in the physical universe, then there just is no free will.
Well, the idea of actualism, you know, this actualist movement, there's only one possible actual outcome. I really don't think that exists in the Star Trek universe. On the contrary, I think that Star Trek's philosophical position here is that there's always more than one possible outcome. I can't think of a single example in any iteration of Star Trek. I tried to wrap my brain around the movies, trying to find an example where they kind of laid the idea out that there's only one possible outcome. I couldn't find it. And again, I think we see it really prevalently to the contrary in Star Trek. I think about the examples of the mirror universe, one of my personal favorites, and I know it's not necessarily one of your favorites, Zachary, but it comes to mind for me is the Next Generation episode Tapestry. I think it's, you know, Star Trek's answer to It's a Wonderful Life, where George Bailey is played by Jean-Luc Picard. Mary, number one.
I love it.
Yeah, isn't it great? I just seem, you know, at the end of that episode, I just seem, you know, Data says, Captain, Dr. Sung said that when a bell rings, a starship captain gets the fourth pip on his collar. And he looks up and he says, way to go, Q, way to go.
I love it. You know, I really think you're onto something there. Star Trek, I'm trying to think how to put this, but it's to me, it's sort of tied up with the optimism of Star Trek. Part of the thing that has always been appealing about Star Trek to me is its optimism. And part of being an optimist is seeing the possibilities for your life or for the future or what reality could be. And if reality is sort of laid out in advance, you know, whether in some sort of deep deterministic or predestined sense, or whether it's just some sort of loose causal deterministic sense, right? If you literally can't affect the course of the future, there's very little reason to be optimistic. And I think you can sort of infer backwards from the fact that Star Trek has this largely optimistic worldview. In fact, I'm thinking of Spock telling Kirk that there are always possibilities, yes. Right? That's part of Spock, even of a logical being like Spock. His worldview is that there are always possibilities. And seeing those possibilities for yourself and for your future and for the future of the world, what the world could be, is part of Star Trek optimism. You know, it's really kind of a fatalistic life if you're only envisioning things as they are right now, or if you think that your future is stuck in some way that you can't affect its outcome. That's a very limited life, and that goes really contrary to the spirit of Star Trek, I think. So while Star Trek doesn't address this issue very directly, I think you can kind of reason backwards and say, well, you know, Star Trek is just ingrained in Star Trek is the idea that you have to have some influence or power to affect the future. And I know that doesn't really answer the metaphysical question, but it does affect our view about what our reaction to the what I would call the threat of determinism, the idea that maybe your actions aren't really free. If you ask what should our reaction be to that, I think, you know, along with Star Trek, we just have to say, look, we can't live our lives that way. And the characters in Star Trek don't react to things that way. And it's a very fatalistic, negative, almost nihilistic view if you take the idea that all of our actions are determined and we can't do anything about your life or the possible outcomes in the future. I don't think anyone wants to live their life that way.
Yeah. And I think back to Tapestry, and I know Q is kind of the wild card character here in this particular episode. But the idea here, I think the question here is, can one decision, one choice, chart the course of the rest of your life? You know, Picard is at the beginning of this episode lamenting a choice that he made as a young man to get into a brawl with these Nausicaans. You know, he saw his actions as very impulsive, very immature. And I think that episode really resonates with most of us. You know, we all wish we could go back and do something different in our past. But here Q allows him to actually go back and make a different choice. So he avoids the fight. He's not impaled through the heart. He doesn't require a mechanical heart transplant. And so he can feel pretty good about that, right? But, you know, the end result here was an entirely different outcome for Picard. You know, he's stuck in a dead-end job as a science officer. He doesn't really make an impact. He's marginal as an officer. He's unimpressive. Riker doesn't take him seriously. Troy doesn't take him seriously. And he's kind of stuck in this dead-end career. He's not the man that he was. And he can, at least in his mind, trace it back to this one impulsive decision that he made as a young man right out of the academy.
I love that you're using that example, because one of the things I like about that episode is Picard's reaction. You know, the Picard that we know, right? This is the Picard that we know, having been captain of the Enterprise, having had all the successes and accomplishments and achievements he's had in his career. And now he's put in an alternate timeline where he, with all of those experiences, has to be a low-ranking functionary on the Enterprise. And his reaction is interesting, because, you know, it wouldn't be the Picard that we know if he wasn't trying to improve his situation, if he wasn't trying to make something happen. And he tries and fails miserably, right? He's trying to make some headway with Riker about getting promoted. He's talking to Counselor Troy about his career and really running up against a wall every time and getting very frustrated. And I think this is actually a good segue into the next topic we want to talk about, existentialism and the existentialist view of free will, because I think all human life is like this, right? You are, in some sense, determined by your past, right? You can't go back and do anything about that. Whatever experiences you have already happened to you, right? And so when Picard finds himself in this alternate timeline, it's like he's literally thrown into an alternate version of his past that he can't do anything about, right? He's got years of experience now of being a low-ranking functionary on the Enterprise, and he can't do anything about that. But what he can do is continue looking forward. Given the position that I'm in right now in my life, what am I going to do about it? Am I going to try to get a promotion? Am I going to try to change careers, find a new interest? And all of human life is like this, right? I can't do anything about what happened yesterday, but every morning I can wake up and say, what am I going to do today? Am I going to change jobs? Am I going to find a new career, get a new interest, make a new friend, challenge myself in some way? And at any moment in your life, you have that that power. And this is kind of the heart of the existentialist view, that there's kind of this paradox to human existence, right? You're thrown into a past that is not of your making. You have all of world history that you can't do anything about. You have your entire family history that you can't do anything about. You can't change anything about what happened yesterday. But at any given moment, you can say, what are we doing today? What are we doing tomorrow? How can I, you know, lift my vision up and project myself into the future? In fact, certain philosophers have a term for this. I'm thinking of Martin Heidegger. He has a term called thrownness, and this actually comes from Jean-Paul Sartre as well. This idea that you're kind of projecting yourself into the future, throwing yourself forward. And humans are always doing that. We're always planning and envisioning what the future could be like. And some people, you know, take some strides towards achieving those goals, and some people sadly never act on that free will that they have. But the existentialist view of free will is the sense that humans just have radical freedom. And at any given moment, you have a freedom to decide what to do with your own life. You can't do anything about what happened yesterday, but you can always make a choice in the here and now. And that strikes me as a lot closer to the spirit of Star Trek to me than this very limited view of determinism, that the idea that human actions are fully determined. Star Trek characters are more like existentialist characters, right? There's something really sad about the Jean-Luc Picard who can't make any headway making his future better in that alternate timeline. We like the Picard who's on the Enterprise and has been successful, and he has some power and authority to go out and shape the world in his own image and in the image of the Federation in some way. If you don't have that freedom to affect the future, it's not a very fulfilling life. And existentialists really embrace this idea that humans just always have radical freedom.
Yeah, and plus that, he just looks terrible in blue.
I'm a fan of the blue. I'm a big fan of the blue shirts. I think blue shirts don't get enough attention on Star Trek. So no, I totally disagree. I like Picard in a blue shirt. I want the captains to wear blue.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Maybe, hey, we'll put that out there. Anyone out there who happens to be working on the next Star Trek project, let's put the captains in blue.
And if you go to my Twitter page, you know, which is just my name, just quick plug for my Twitter page, just at ZacharyFruling.com, you notice there's a blue theme there. I'm all about the blue in Star Trek. So
yeah.
No, Picard needs to wear blue.
Hashtag captains in blue.
Hashtag captains in blue.
There you go.
100%.
You know, the thing that fascinates me about this, Zachary, is that the idea that not choosing is even a choice. I think it was a Christian philosopher, and yeah, I'm going to call him a philosopher, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who said, not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. So there's this idea that not even choosing almost by default is a choice. You know, you have the humanistic psychologists like Abraham Maslow, for instance, who believe that freedom's not only possible, but it is absolutely necessary in order for us to become fully functional human beings, that it's necessary for us to have a free will choice. Your personal agency becomes a means to the path that we go down in life and the consequences that lead us to self-actualization. In Christianity, we refer to the doctrine of free will, which in a nutshell says that free will or personal choice is a part of God's design, that it's a gift in which we as human beings are radically free to choose our own paths in life, even if that choice means to reject God and his moral, ethical, social, spiritual truth, and that we're ultimately also going to have to face the consequences of those choices. And I think one of the best examples of this kind of existential freedom comes in the episode, the original Star Trek pilot, The Cage, which becomes part of the season one original series episode, Menagerie. You know, Captain Pike's taken captive by the Talosians. The Keeper's manipulating everything around him in order to facilitate a relationship with a human woman who's also being held. So Pike is determined to hang on to his free will with everything that he's got in him. And he discovers that hate is an emotion that the Talosians can't read through. So he can't really control his circumstances, right? But he can control his emotions. He can control his attitude, you know, in these circumstances. In the end, you know, Pike's even willing to choose suicide to make the point to the Keeper that his free will can't be taken from him. And I love that line. When the Keeper realizes that holding him captive isn't going to work, he says to Pike, "The customs and history of your race show a unique hatred of captivity. Even when it is pleasant and benevolent, you prefer death." You know, in the beginning of this episode, Pike was really weary of the way to command, right? At the beginning of the episode, he's talking to the ship's surgeon. You know, he's pouring his heart out to this guy. He says, you know, I'm tired of this weight, this, you know, fire weapons or not to fire weapons. Who goes on the away missions? Who lives? Who dies? But what Pike comes to understand at the end of this episode is that choice is really an incredible gift. And I think that's a powerful message.
Yeah, what I love about that example is that it's such a close parallel to the way that existentialist philosophers talk about the weight of responsibility, right? If you are radically in charge of your own life, right? If at any given moment you have the power to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going left or am I going right? Then in some sense, you're shaping your own life every single moment of every single day. Like, life is moving on whether you want it to or not. And at any given moment, you have the choice to do various things. And I think all of us have experienced this, where if you start to feel constrained, like you really don't have a choice, if you feel stuck in some way, if you feel stuck in a job that you're not happy with, or if you're stuck in a relationship that you're not happy with, or if you're stuck with a family situation that you're not happy with, you can kind of get the sense that your freedom is limited, right? You don't have the choices that you wish you had. And there's a term for this. The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre called not recognizing your own freedom bad faith. It's kind of a funny term. I never really thought the term made much sense to me, but bad faith. The idea that we don't always recognize the extent of our own freedom, and if we feel artificially constrained or limited by factors outside of our control, that is doing a disservice to our free will, right? If you look at those examples I just mentioned, you know, if you're in a job that you don't like, you have options, right? You know, it's very easy to feel like, look, I have to go to work every day and I slave away and I can't do anything about it. And I like Captain Picard on the Enterprise in that alternate timeline, right? Wearing the blue shirt. If he feels constrained and stuck, like he's not going anywhere, that ignores the possibilities that he does have, right? He can work a little harder at convincing Riker. He can try to get some additional training. He could always leave Starfleet at very least, right? And choose a civilian career. There's 1,000 options that Captain Picard in that situation has, but if he starts to feel stuck and constrained, then he is not recognizing his own freedom, and that's something that Jean-Paul Sartre would have called bad faith. And I think we're just all in that situation. At any given moment, you can make radical choices to affect your outcome. We tend to sort of box ourselves in, right? I'm in a certain job and I'm in a certain lifestyle. You know, I'm in my house that I have to pay a mortgage for, and that's sort of what life is. But if you sort of step outside your box and realize, hey, there's a universe of possibilities out there. As Spock would say, there are always possibilities. Now you're much closer to recognizing your free will and thinking outside the box and projecting yourself into those different types of possibilities. So I think of Star Trek as really wedded to this idea that humans have radical free will, but there's a weight to that. You know, you mentioned Captain Pike in the pilot of Star Trek, The Cage. You know, Captain Pike is starting to feel the weight of command, right? He gets to be the one in charge, the one who decides who lives and who dies, and he feels a weight of responsibility that is starting to eat away at him, right? He's presumably had to order people under his command to their deaths, just like Counselor Troy has to learn to order Geordi LaForge to his death in that episode when she's learning to be a certified bridge commander. You know, if you have that weight of responsibility, that can really weigh you down. You can really wish that you didn't have free will anymore, right? You don't want that responsibility. And if you're radically in charge of your own life, and if you're radically in charge of shaping the world around you as a result of your choices, right? I'm just one person in the world, right? But I've got free will to shape my life and the community around me, and everyone else around me has free will to shape their lives and the community around them, such that any choice we make is part of shaping the world around us. So on the existentialist view, we have really, really radical freedom to shape the world and in the Star Trek universe, the universe, right? The characters in Star Trek have the power to shape what the Federation becomes and how that unfolds in the future and what their relationships are on a very, not just a global scale, a galactic scale. And there is a huge weight that comes with that. And I think it's very easy to want to run and hide from your own free will. And that's doing a disservice, because you always have the ability to make really radical choices. You know, what if Captain Picard, you know, not being happy with his situation in that alternate timeline, he could just throw his hands up and say, I'm doing something totally different. I don't like, you know, how I got where I am. Totally ignore Q and just say, I'm going to go do something totally different with my life. That's a choice that he has, but in feeling stuck, he's doing a disservice to his own free will. And that's the existentialist view. I think there's this idea that you can't do anything about the past. You can't do anything about how you got where you are, but darn it, I'm going to make a choice today, and I'm going to make a choice for tomorrow. I'm going to shape the world in my own image. I'm going to decide what values are important to me, and I'm going to make those choices, even the hard choices or the radical choices.
Yeah, I think that was Pike's dilemma as well. There were these circumstances he couldn't do anything about. I mean, he's stuck there. He's being held by the Talosians. He can't do anything about that. They're surrounding him with all of these different scenarios, right? They're trying to manipulate his surroundings to get him to make a different choice. So he has to come to terms with his attitude about the circumstances that are beyond his control. I mean, after all, our minds control our attitudes control our actions. So the attitudes that he has about the circumstances that are beyond his control really shape the choices that he makes. A lot like O'Brien, when he returned from this quasi-imprisonment in the episode Hard Time on DS9. Though it was only a memory engram that was implanted, it was real to him, and he had to learn to live with it. There was nothing he could do about it. They had explored other options. The doctor decided it couldn't be purged, and so he's got to live with this memory engram, and he's got to figure out how to come to terms with it. He's got to shape his attitudes about it. So, you know, learning to live with what's happened to him is kind of the larger topic of the entire episode. So that this memory becomes something that he can't control. So now he has to adapt, you know, and come to terms with what he's going to do with the rest of his life in light of these circumstances, this memory that he can't do anything about.
Yeah, you know, I used to teach philosophy, and part of that is teaching logic. And in logic, you get Venn diagrams, right? And as I think about the existentialist view of free will, and you got everyone who knows me is going to laugh. Oh no, Zach's talking about Venn diagrams again. But I sort of envision a Venn diagram. Right, on the left would be a circle of things I can't do anything about, and that would be the past or circumstances beyond my control. On the right would be, you know, the sort of radical view of free will, and the intersection is where you want to be. Right, there are things you can't do anything about, and if you live too much on the left side of that Venn diagram, you're not recognizing your own free will. You're feeling stuck and constrained artificially. You're living in a very sort of pessimistic, uninspired, limited life. On the other hand, if you're living too far on the right side of the Venn diagram, if you embrace your radical freedom so much that you're unrealistic, that you're not taking into account the things that you can't do anything about, then you really have a lot of pie in the sky dreams that aren't realistic, that you're not taking any practical steps towards. So in the middle is this sort of the perfect intersection of recognizing the things you can't do anything about, and you can control your reactions to those, right? You know, there are things you can control, and one of them is your attitude, your emotional and mental reactions to things you can't control. And then you can start to think constructively, given all of that, how can I take whatever steps are necessary to get where I want to be and move a little more towards the right side of that Venn diagram. But there you go. So that's my existentialist free will determinism Venn diagram.
Yeah, Venn diagrams and balance sheets, the greatest inventions of the modern age. I really believe that.
I'm not sure talking about Venn diagrams on a podcast is the most inspiring. Like, this is not the most interesting topic. But I think this is true, right? You know, in any given situation, and I think in Star Trek, any character is like this, right? If you're in the captain's chair, you have to imagine, what are the things I can't do anything about, right? I've got a Romulan warbird off the bow of my ship, right? I can't do anything about that. But what can I do?
Warp to Ryza.
Warp, get out of there and go to Ryza. Or you can hide and run to the holodeck like Barclay, right? That's an option too. So there's a palette of available options to choose from at any given point in your life, no matter what the situation is. Some of them are more constructive than others, but you don't want to err so much on the side of free will. I think this is just the danger of the existentialist view, right? If you embrace your free will so much that you're unrealistic, you're going to make some really bad choices in life.
Indeed. So I think this is a great segue into pragmatism. You know, I think every captain probably in Star Trek at his core is more or less pragmatic, especially Archer and Kirk, but I think every one of them at their core. Let's talk a little bit about pragmatism.
I think you almost have to be a pragmatist if you're a commander of a starship, right? Those choices are going to confront you. You don't have the luxury of indulging in this metaphysical question that we're indulging ourselves in right now, right? We're asking sort of this esoteric metaphysical question. Do we really have free will in some deep sense? You know, when I make a choice, is that a really deep metaphysical genuine choice, or is that just sort of an apparent pseudo choice that's really determined by previous causal factors, right? And philosophers like to engage in that kind of debate. But when you are captain of a starship and you've got a Romulan warbird off your bow, you don't have the luxury of stepping back and saying, okay, when I react to this, is my reaction determined by my training, or are my actions determined by my cultural upbringing in the Federation, right? You are forced to make a choice, and the choices force themselves on you. And I think that's the heart of the pragmatic view, that free will is such an ingrained part of our view of ourselves, right? It's a concept that we just can't do without. It's hard to imagine what a human life would be like without free will. It's so tied to our way we hold other people responsible for their actions. It's so tied to our sense of personal identity, who we are. Our sense of self-identity is what I mean to say. And, you know, if we lose that sense of free will, we lose a really crucial part of human life. So I should say that the pragmatic view is, in philosophy in general, pragmatism is this idea that we accept things as true if they have some practical import, if they work better than other views, or if they have some practical output, right? And, you know, arguably you can say, look, free will is such a practical concept. We just can't do without that concept. So it's kind of a meaningless metaphysical mumbo jumbo kind of question to keep forcing this deep question. Yeah, but do we really have free will? Yes, when you're making a choice and you decide to go to RISA, is that a real choice or is that just a pseudo apparent choice based on all these deterministic factors that we talked about last week? Pragmatists just reject the question outright, and they say, look, you know, free will is such an ingrained part of our sense of ourselves and the way we navigate in the world. Like I said, the choices force themselves on you. You can't just sit in a room and turn the lights out and not make any choices. Every single time you wake up, every single time you walk out the front door, 1,000 choices are going to confront you in the course of your day. And likewise, if you're commander of a starship, 1,000 choices are going to confront you in the course of your day in the captain's chair, and you just can't ignore them. So, you know, asking ourselves whether we really have free will is just a meaningless question on that view.
I personally would like to be confronted with the choice to warp to RISA, just saying.
I would love to have, you know, I would love to have like Captain Kirk here next to me, or I could talk to him and I could say, James, you know, what do you think of this question of free will and determinism? And he would say, I think this is a really stupid question, right? When I've got a choice to make, I'm not going to stop and ask, you know, how my choice is being made, whether I'm really in charge. You are in charge. And that's just sort of the factual reality of being a starship commander. And I think it's a little bit less like that for other characters, right? If you have almost any other role on the ship, you have to deal with the orders and the rules that are handed to you from above, right? That's part of having a chain of command and in any chain of command, whether it's a chain of command in Starfleet or here in the actual world, whether it's a chain of command in a business or maybe even some sort of family hierarchy. But even those characters, to some extent, you know, they have to act, right? They have to decide what to do given any new situation that confronts them. And there's just, you'd almost just don't have the luxury of entertaining this esoteric metaphysical question on that account. Even if you decide to embrace determinism, right? If you sort of say, yeah, okay, I'm going to live my life as if I don't have free will, and I'm just going to chalk everything that happens to me up to some other factor that's outside my control, it doesn't matter, right? You still have to go through your day and you still have to make choices, and there are still going to be Romulan warbirds that are going to show up on your bow sometimes, and you have to do something about them. So the pragmatist view is just this idea that, look, we accept those things as true that have practical value, and I think of anything that has really practical value, I would say our sense of free will philosophically is something that if we entertain the notion of rejecting that concept, we just lose so much of human experience that it wouldn't be a life we want to live. It wouldn't be a life that is practical to live. And of course, you know, the metaphysician in me says, well, yeah, so what? That doesn't make it true, right? Just because, you know, we can't do without this idea of free will, you can still ask this deeper question, but do we really have free will? How does reality really work? And this is circling back to the idea of the principle of alternate possibilities, right? That's a metaphysical idea that says, look, for us to have free will, reality just has to be set up a certain way. There have to be different possible outcomes. And if there's not, we just plain don't have free will. So I kind of envision a debate here between pragmatists who would just reject the question outright and existentialists who would just say, no matter what happens, we have radical free will to make whatever, you know, to make 1,000 choices, even in situations that seem really constrained. But the metaphysicians want to come along and say, well, what about reality? How is reality set up? And is reality really set up in such a way that multiple possible outcomes are really possible? And if not, you know, you existentialists and you pragmatists can talk about free will all you want. You starship commander sitting in your captain's chair can talk about free will and personal agency and being in command and the burden of command all you want, but that doesn't make it true that we really metaphysically have free will. So that's kind of the dichotomy as I see it. You know, this practical existentialist sense of free will and this really deeper metaphysical sense of free will that needs to be proven in some way.
Yeah, when we're talking about pragmatism, the word pragmatism is derived from the Greek word pragma, meaning a thing or fact. And it comes from the Greek word prazo, which means to achieve. So the idea here is to achieve something. It's an end to a means. This, after all, it's the idea that thought's simply a tool for action or problem solving. So the quintessential pragmatic captain really doesn't have time to debate the finer points of philosophy. You weigh the facts and then you make a decision. And I think we see that again. I think that's most prevalent probably in Archer and Kirk, interestingly enough, being sort of, as we understand it, the first two starship captains kind of out there doing that thing. Archer more so than Kirk. Kirk was definitely pragmatic in the way that he broke a decision down. It wasn't about philosophy. Now, when we get to Picard, who I think probably is the completed evolution of the starship captain as we know it, I mean, he did weigh the finer points of philosophy sometimes. But I think if you peel the layers away, in the end, he's very pragmatic in the way he comes to a decision. He just, you know, he weighs the facts, he makes a decision. And I think that's true of anyone that's going to sit in that captain's chair.
Yeah, I think for the purpose of the discussion, we're sort of lumping pragmatism and existentialism together. And to me, it makes sense to say that of the various types of characters you get in Star Trek, the various roles on, you know, if we're looking at the Starship Enterprise, right, the various roles on the Enterprise, the captain is the most existentially free, right? They're in command. Captains are the people on the ship who have the most authority and the most freedom. But you know, if you go back to the original Star Trek, Captain Kirk on the original Enterprise out on the frontier, right? This was supposed to be a Western in space, right? If you're in a Western movie and you're out in the frontier, you don't have the government looking over your shoulder, right? You're out on the frontier with no authority backing you up. And that's what the original Star Trek was supposed to be like, right? This is a wagon train to the stars, as Gene Roddenberry called it. But Captain Kirk out on the frontier had really radical authority to act, right? When he would encounter a new race or a new situation, that was the job of the captain, was to be the authority and to act without a safety net. So I kind of envision, as you go further back in time in Star Trek history, you kind of get progressively more and more existentialist type characters. Jonathan Archer out there in the show Enterprise, right? The Federation hadn't even been formed yet. So these concepts that constrain future starship captains' actions, I'm thinking of things like the Prime Directive, right? These fundamental principles that are supposed to guide and shape the actions that starship commanders follow. And, you know, if those haven't been formulated yet, it's really the actions and the choices and the values of Jonathan Archer that help formulate those ideas in the first place. So even more so than Captain Kirk, Captain Archer is out there without a safety net, and he is really radically free to shape what becomes the Federation in his own choices. And that, I think, is very much in the spirit of the core of existentialism, right? That you are shaping reality and you're shaping the future with every single choice you make. And I think this was really written into the character of Jonathan Archer intentionally, right? He's the most radically free existentialist captain who makes choices based on his own intuitions and his own values without a safety net. And as you get further in the future in Star Trek history, those starship captains, while they're still starship captains, right, they still have a lot of free will. They still have a lot of authority to act within a sphere, but that sphere seems narrower and narrower, right? Captain Picard doesn't have the luxury of willy-nilly just blowing off the Prime Directive, although he does that sometimes when doing so is more compatible with his intuitions or seems like the right thing to do in some sort of moral dilemma. But there's constraints on the actions of starship commanders in the future that don't exist for the original in the original Star Trek and in Enterprise. So I think of Jonathan Archer as just sort of the quintessential existentialist captain, right? He has no safety net. He can make whatever choice he feels is best. He's far out on the frontier, at least, you know, being limited to warp 5s. He's as far on the frontier as you could be at the time. But he can't even fall back on the Prime Directive. That idea doesn't exist yet. He has to learn the Prime Directive and learn through experience that is a good principle to follow. But it's not like it's handed to him from above.
You keep bringing up this thing, the Prime Directive. I mean, you must be talking about that non-interference crap that T'Pol keeps shoving down our throats.
Yeah, and that's a wonderfully existential reaction, right? Like, yeah, so thanks for the advice, T'Pol, but I'm going to do what I think is best. And I think, you know, as I look at my own life, I make choices like that. You know, here's what other people are telling me I should be doing. Here's what my experience, here's how my experience has shaped my reality. But, you know, literally, I'm going to ignore all that, and I'm going to do what I think is best. I'm going to make a choice, and I'm going to do something different. And Jonathan Archer has that freedom. Whereas, you know, if Captain Picard said to an admiral, let's call them a badmiral, right? If Captain Picard said to a badmiral, I'm going to ignore the prime directive, you know, he'd be drummed out of Starfleet. He just doesn't have that luxury. But I think of the early captains in Star Trek as being really existentialist characters, almost irreverent. They, you know, if that's your attitude and if that is your approach and you don't have a safety net, almost every choice you make has to be some sort of irreverent choice. It's hard to imagine making a radical choice without a safety net, without being something of a rebel. Let's call it a rebel.
Yeah. So Zachary, we have this idea of determinism, and we've looked at it extensively in our last episode through the lens of Star Trek. Today we've been talking a little bit about free will, personal agency. We've talked about the pragmatic view, the existential view. We've looked at the principle of alternate possibilities, or PAP. So when we talk about these two things, are they compatible? Can we exist under the laws of both of these?
We want to talk about a sort of a third option, right? There's this view of determinism that we talked about. There's this view of free will. And on the surface, it looks like they're really incompatible with each other. Right. If all my actions are determined by previous events and I can't do anything about those, then it looks like I don't have free will. And that's sort of the core of that idea of the principle of alternate possibilities that we talked about. But there is this third position in the philosophical discussion about free will and determinism called compatibilism. And as you could infer from the name, it's the idea that free will and determinism are compatible with each other, that they can both be true at the same time, that they don't outright contradict each other. And interestingly enough, I think this is the most prevalent or popular view on the topic of free will and determinism these days. Historically, it goes all the way back to a philosopher named David Hume, who first sort of formulated the idea. But it's this idea that even though your actions may be fully determined, some actions can be freely chosen at the same time. And there's kind of this classic example of, it's kind of a silly example, as a great many philosophical examples are, but the example of maybe being tied to a chair, right? If you're, like, I'm recording a podcast tonight, if I'm tied to my chair and I literally can't do anything else, I can't break free of my constraints, then there's only one future course of action, right? I'm constrained and it's determined that I'll be stuck in my chair. But if for some reason I decide that I really want to be here, like tonight, I really want to be here recording this podcast with you. So if even though I'm tied to the chair, if I freely choose to be where I'm at, and that's the sort of the best vision of reality for myself, right? A choice that I'm freely making, then it sure looks like you can have your cake and eat it too, right? You're fully determined to be in that chair, but if you're choosing it at the same time, even though you're constrained, it's still a freely chosen action. And so that's the heart of compatibilism, the idea that free will and determinism can both be true at the same time. But of course, this is a podcast about Star Trek and philosophy. So we have to ask, how does this manifest itself in the Star Trek universe? Can we find examples of compatibilism, the idea that fully determined actions can also be freely chosen? Are there any examples or characters or situations in the Star Trek universe that come to mind? I've got a couple, but I want to hear what you've got, Mike.
Well, I think primarily of Benjamin Sisko embracing his role as the emissary. When we first meet Benjamin Sisko, he's not even thinking about the prophets or being the emissary of the prophets. He is getting ready to take command of Deep Space Nine. It's a job that he doesn't want. And so he finds himself kind of out there on the frontier in deep space and not really wanting to be there. He's got a young son to raise by himself. He's still mourning the loss of his wife. And so he finds himself face to face with the wormhole aliens or the prophets. And he finds himself thrust into this position as the emissary. And it's something that he just doesn't embrace. Not only does he have no interest in being the emissary, he doesn't even want to be in command of Deep Space Nine. So we see him really embrace that role first, but it's not really until the fourth season episode, Ascension, that we see him really embrace his role as emissary. It took the Bajoran poet Corum Lan his appearance from the wormhole, claiming to be the emissary after disappearing 200 years earlier, for Sisko to really realize that this is his destiny, that he's destined to be the emissary of the prophets. We see him start to embrace that. And then over the course of the next three seasons, we see him little by little assume that role. You know, we see him develop even further when he discovers, you know, the opening, or rather the face in the sand in the opening episode of season seven. Actually, it was that cliffhanger, season six, season seven. But it was season seven, Image in the Sand, when he finds out that he's in fact part prophet himself, you know, and then we see him really embrace that destiny for himself. So, you know, there are definitely these causal factors here that he can't do anything about, but it's little by little that he feels more comfortable accepting that mantle of emissary of the prophets.
I'm glad you thought of the example of Sisko, because this was on my list as well. Right. Sisko is the emissary, right? If you sort of take Bajoran prophecy at face value, in other words, if those prophecies are true, and as I think of our discussion we had last week about determinism, this is a type of theological determinism, right? If Bajoran prophecies are true and Sisko is the emissary to the prophets, whether or not he wants to be, right? He, at the beginning of Deep Space Nine, he's the emissary and he doesn't want to be, right? In fact, it's an idea that makes him nervous and uncomfortable, reinforces the idea that he doesn't want to be on Deep Space Nine at all. And of course, it makes Starfleet very nervous. They don't want him to be the emissary, but they want the Bajorans to join the Federation so much that they're willing to tolerate it. But he hasn't embraced his destiny. And that's, I think, the heart of this compatibilist view. If events are determined, then there's kind of a destiny to things, right? There's a future that's preordained, maybe not in some deep way, but in Deep Space Nine, it is this in this deep theological way, right? Sisko is the emissary. And it takes him a couple of seasons, right? At least until season three or four, and in some ways leading up to season six and seven, the cliffhanger that you mentioned at the beginning of season seven. It takes Sisko quite a long time to embrace his destiny as and embrace his role as the emissary. But once he's done that, that strikes me as an example of compatibilism. And this is really interesting to me, right? Sisko doesn't have any choice in the matter. He is the emissary whether he wants to be or not. But once he's embraced the role, now he's making a freely chosen choice to be the emissary. And it's as much of an emotional choice as anything. It has to do, I think, with his emotional reaction to being the emissary. It has to do with his the types of choices that he makes in response to being the emissary. But once he's embraced it, that looks a lot like compatibilism to me, right? He can't do anything else. He's the emissary whether he wants to be or not. And once he's embraced it, it's a freely chosen state of being. So that's compatibilism, right? He's determined to be the emissary, and he's also freely choosing to be. So there is no distinction between free will and determinism, or no contradiction.
You mentioned in your initial example, you likened it to being tied to a chair. And I know that kind of is an image, so to speak, of Picard in Chain of Command. And I know we talked about this on the other side of the room. That was one of the examples that you had thought of.
As I'm thinking about compatibilism in Star Trek, one thing I want to try to do is try to find ways of telling these typical, canonical, well-known examples of examples and principles in the history of philosophy, but using Star Trek examples. So the example that I mentioned earlier, the example of being tied to a chair, what's the Star Trek equivalent of that? And the example that comes immediately to mind is Picard being tied up, or not really tied up, but hanging from his wrists in that episode Chain of Command in that Cardassian, it's not a prison, but a prison room, right? He's being held captive and he's hanging and he can't do anything else, right? He's literally hanging from his wrists. And in that episode, Picard is given a choice, right? He can continue to struggle against being held captive, but he can also embrace the idea, right? The Cardassian in that episode offers him a chance to live a life of luxury and sit around thinking about philosophy and literature and archaeology and really, in some sense, Captain Picard's ideal kind of lifestyle, right? Having the luxury to think about these interests that even as captain of the Enterprise, he doesn't have the luxury to indulge in those interests as much as he would like. And so Picard is faced with a choice. He can learn to love his captivity. He can will himself to see five lights instead of four in that episode. And if he does that, in some sense, he is freely choosing his captivity. And again, that looks like compatibilism to me. If he literally can't do anything else, if he's going to be held captive, whether or not he wants to be, assuming he's never going to be rescued by his colleagues on the Enterprise, if he's stuck being a Cardassian prisoner, he can decide how to make the most of that. He can continue to struggle and fight against it, just like all of us can continue to struggle and fight against the factors that shape our own lives. Or you can embrace the reality of your situation and freely choose to flourish inside that captivity. It's still not a very satisfying existence, right? I think Picard rightly says, internally, he says, I can't do that, right? I would be losing too much of my humanity if I were to embrace being a captive, right? Picard is too much of an existentialist for that. And of course, rightly, he's not going to be content to be a blue shirt and a low-level functionary on the Enterprise where people don't even know his name, right? That's not who Captain Picard is. And he's not going to choose that any more than he's going to choose being a Cardassian prisoner. But if he did, that looks a lot like compatibility. It is possible to freely choose to do the very thing that you're destined to do, that you can't do anything else, right? If you're literally a prisoner and tied up by your wrists, you can't do anything else, but you can control your reactions to that. And I think that's the heart of the compatibilist position, that you can freely choose to do something that you have no power to do otherwise.
I think we see this play out a lot with Captain Janeway in the Delta Quadrant throughout the entire series of Voyager, you know, struggling with this idea, you know, do we stay loyal to these Starfleet principles now that we're stranded here in the Delta Quadrant? What do we do? You know, do we hold on to our principles or do we become marauders? Do we do whatever we've got to do, you know, to get back to the Alpha Quadrant? I think that was a common thread throughout all seven seasons of Voyager.
I didn't realize this until we started talking about this, Mike, but it occurs to me as we're talking about the captains, how much of the progression of the character development of the captains has to do with learning to embrace their own destiny, right? Sisko has to learn to embrace his role as the emissary. And like you mentioned a second ago, Mike, Janeway has to learn to embrace the idea that Voyager is stuck in the Delta Quadrant. I love that example because if Voyager is literally stuck in the Delta Quadrant, then there's nothing Janeway can do about it, right? Sort of finding a wormhole, and Lord knows they try to find a wormhole in Voyager. But assuming they don't, then Janeway can't do anything about being stuck in the Delta Quadrant. Nothing short of literally making a choice between do I set course for home and, you know, come hell or high water, we're going to get there someday, or she could make the opposite choice. They could choose to settle some planet and stay stuck in the Delta Quadrant and just embrace a new life in the Delta Quadrant. That's an option. So the existentialist in me wants to say, look, Janeway's got a thousand options, right? She chooses to set a course towards home, but she has other options. But that's not part of Janeway's character. So assuming that's not a real option, then Janeway has to learn to embrace the idea of being stuck in the Delta Quadrant. And she chooses to remain a Starfleet ship, even given the factualness of their situation, right? She can't do anything about their situation, but she chooses to embrace the idea that they're a Starfleet ship inside the Delta Quadrant. You know, not everyone made that choice, right? Captain Ransom in the episode Equinox, he made the opposite choice, right? He chose not to embrace being a Starfleet captain in the Delta Quadrant and started making some very bad choices as a result. But Janeway's character development is learning to embrace her destiny. And just like Sisko had to learn to embrace his role as the emissary. The last example that comes to mind is Captain Kirk, right? Captain Kirk in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, has to be reminded by Spock that commanding the Enterprise or commanding a starship is his first best destiny, right? At the beginning of Star Trek II, Captain Kirk is feeling old and tired and worn out, and he's an admiral. He's not out there hopping galaxies, as McCoy tells him inside his apartment in San Francisco. But by the end of Star Trek II, Captain Kirk has been re-energized, right? He has re-embraced the idea that his destiny is to be on the bridge of a starship, and that is who he is and his best destiny. And so if you really take this idea of destiny seriously, that there is kind of a first best role for yourself, a first best way of life, And you can fight against that and try to do something else. And sometimes life puts you in situations where you're not doing what you're destined to be doing. But when you really embrace your destiny, that opens up a sphere of possibilities and it rejuvenates Captain Kirk. And I think this is a type of compatibilism, right? It's Kirk's destiny to be a starship captain. That's who he is, right? And again, we're in universe right now. This is the character Kirk. Kirk is a starship captain. And anyone with an IQ above room temperature would say, look, Kirk has to be a starship captain, right? Any other role for Kirk is a waste. And Spock tells him as much. But Kirk has to come to realize that himself and embrace that idea. And at the end of Star Trek II, he tells Carol Marcus that he feels young again.
I think that was a pickup line. It sure sounds like, Carol, I feel young again.
This isn't J.J. Abrams. This isn't the Abrams universe, right? So there's no pickup lines in Star Trek II. But you know, at the end of Star Trek II, Captain Kirk feels young again, and there's a reason I think that that's a really favorite moment for a lot of people inside that movie, and maybe inside the entire movie franchise, right? We want Captain Kirk to feel young on the bridge of that starship and embrace his destiny and ride that starship into the future, right? And if he's not doing that, then it's a waste. But if you tell that story in terms of this philosophical language, free will and determinism and compatibilism, that is a matter of Captain Kirk embracing his destiny. And that sounds like compatibilism to me.
Yeah, because when we first find him in Star Trek the Motion Picture, he's an admiral. You know, he's the one sitting at the desk making decisions. And he kind of, you know, cans Decker for all intents and purposes.
He's a badmiral.
Oh, he's a badmiral. He is the king of badmirals.
He was the prototypical badmiral. I guess you can find badmirals in the original Star Trek, but insofar as Star Trek the Motion Picture was a very bad attempt to relaunch the franchise in some way, you know, Kirk is the badmiral.
But it's funny when you see a badmiral in that light. The interesting thing here is you're cheering for him. You want him to be captain of the Enterprise. That's where he belongs. He belongs in that chair on that bridge of the 1701 USS Enterprise. Not Decker, Captain Kirk. I don't want Decker. I want Captain Kirk.
Yeah, and there's a twinkle that Captain Kirk gets in his eye, and this is largely because of William Shatner's acting, right? And I'm thinking of Star Trek III when he is telling the Admiral, the Badmiral, that he is he sees his point, that he hears the Admiral's advice. He's not going to go try to take the Enterprise and go find Spock. And you see a twinkle in his eye that says, you know, Captain Kirk is going to ignore that order and he's going to get on that ship, come hell or high water, and he's going to ride off into the stars and make things happen. And that's what I love about those characters, all the captains, but mainly Kirk in this regard. There's a twinkle in your eye when you see the future possibilities and you know you're going to do something about it. And Kirk is just this manifestation of this existential drive into the future for me.
It's the same twinkle Janeway gets when she sees wormholes and coffee behind every nebula.
That's right. For Janeway, it's coffee in her eyes. Like what's that song? You're so vain, right? there's a line in that song, clouds in my coffee, right?
Clouds in my
Janeway
coffee.
Janeway sees coffee in the nebula for Janeway.
There should have been an episode called Wormholes and Coffee. Wormholes and Coffee. There you go.
I love it. So Janeway has no free will whatsoever until she gets her morning coffee, and I can relate to that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the only other example that I could really think of, I thought about Data in Nemesis, and I think this brings us full circle in this discussion. You know, his self-sacrifice in that movie, his choice to lay his life down, his existence down to save Captain Picard, you know, it certainly raises the question, I think, was this an ultimate choice? Was this his choice? Or was it a matter of programming? Was this just an algorithm that he was responding to? And it really brings our conversation full circle. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
You know, as I think about Data in Nemesis, it's supposed to be the culmination of his story arc, right? Sacrificing himself is supposed to be something that a machine wouldn't do. And I'm thinking of things like Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, right? You know, if you were programming a robot, you'd program in self-preservation, and you might program in, except in the situation where human life is on the line. So it's easy to kind of imagine that, okay, maybe this is part of Data's programming. Maybe he's been programmed, not to sacrifice himself, unless he's in this very dire situations when human life is at risk, he can sacrifice himself in that situation. But there's something emotional about that scene where you know Data is transcending being a mere android, and he is making a very radical choice that isn't a day. It's not an ordinary choice. It's not to. It's not a choice between choosing tea or coffee. Right. This isn't Janeway choosing her morning coffee. This is a being choosing to sacrifice itself. And there's something noble about that. And we don't think of androids as being noble if they are merely following their programming. So it's supposed to be an example of data transcending his programming, whether it really is or not. I mean, this is the whole point of the discussion. I don't think we're gonna answer the question with any certainty here. But it tugs at our heartstrings. We want Data to be that noble, and we want him to find an outside-the-box way to transcend the situation, and he does all of those things. And so, in my mind, it's I don't know if it's the quintessential free action, but it's not one you ordinarily think of as an android doing, right? If I were programming an android, I might say I wouldn't think to program self-sacrifice into that android right off the bat. So it strikes me as a freely chosen action. If anything Data does is free, that it's got to be that.
I agree. Well, Zachary, we've been talking for about an hour about free will. Any final thoughts?
Well, like I said last time, I think Star Trek does a better job of raising philosophical questions than answering them. And I think that's the case with this free will determinism debate in general. There are some examples in Star Trek, many different types of determinism, all the things we talked about in episode one last week. And then as you look through different examples of free will and existentialism and pragmatism, there's no shortage of those examples either. So what's fascinating to me is the way that different situations and characters sort of pull your intuitions one way or the other. And we really can flesh out the full palette of philosophical options, different types of determinism, different types of free will. What would it mean for them to be compatible? And we flesh that out in terms of the characters of the captains. But it was really kind of a revelation to me that tied up with this philosophical idea of compatibilism is this character development for these characters, the idea that you have to learn to embrace your own destiny. And so I think this is kind of a moral allegory for me, right? All of us have things we can't control, but there's a lot we can control. We can control our reactions. We can project ourselves into the future, and we can shape our own lives and shape the world around us. And it's really, really tragic when you see characters in literature or in Star Trek not embracing their own free will, not trying to do something about the things that they're not happy with in life. And it's freeing when you start to see possibilities that you didn't see before. So, you know, the moral fable for me here is to look at Star Trek as a type of inspiration. Imagine yourself on the bridge of the Enterprise, and what would you do in that situation? You know, if you really think globally and think galactically and imagine possibilities for yourself into the future, it's almost as if every single person on the planet is captain of his or her own starship. So I sort of view Star Trek as a challenge, right? Star Trek, yeah, they're fascinating adventure stories, they're morality plays, there are philosophical issues in Star Trek that we're going to talk about now and for the foreseeable future on Metatrex here. But there is this kind of personal application for me, right? There's a moral to the story that I, at every turn, need to remind myself that I can shape my own life and I can shape the world around me. And there's something tragic when characters in Star Trek don't do that. The Picard who's stuck in the alternate timeline wearing the blue shirt. That's a tragic version of Picard. And it's tragic. It's a tragic human life to be so constrained and stuck by your situation that you don't see possibilities for yourself. So I want this to be inspiring, right? When I see Captain Kirk have a twinkle in his eye, I want that to be a reminder to me that I have free will too. I can walk out that door every single day and I can make reality what I want it to be as if I were captain of my own starship. So that's how I see it. I don't know if we're really going to settle the philosophical issue of free will and determinism. I think there's probably no way to settle it. For every example of free will you can find, you can probably tell a story about how that example is fully constrained and explainable by causal factors that are outside your control. But that's not a human life. And I think there's something really, really fundamental about this existentialist pragmatic view that we have to embrace our free will. And that's the only way anything gets done in the world. That's the only way people have a fulfilling life. And if you don't live a life like that, you're more of a tragic character than an inspired one. And we all want to be on the inspirational side, I think. That's why we're all Star Trek fans. We like the optimism. And part of that optimism is embracing your free will and embracing future possibilities. So for me, there's sort of two parts of my personality. I'm a philosopher. I care a lot about this deep philosophical question about free will and determinism. It's one of the more interesting philosophical questions to me. But there's another side of me, the other side of the coin, that says, I just fundamentally don't care, right? What am I going to do with my life every single day when I wake up? That has nothing to do with free will and determinism. That has everything to do with embracing my own view of free will. And whether it's really, really free will in some genuine metaphysical sense just doesn't matter when I ask myself, what do I want to accomplish in this life? And when Captain Kirk walks onto that bridge of the Enterprise, it just doesn't matter whether his actions are determined or not. That's not what it means to be a starship commander, and I think that's not what it means to be a human.
My final thoughts can be summed up in three words. Picard in blue.
Picard in blue. Are you telling me, Mike, that you're living a tragic life?
I
hope not.
I'm simply
for
reminded.
Your own sake.
I'm simply reminded that what I often perceive as my worst decisions, my worst choices, all of the things that I look back on and I lament, at the end of the day, they make me who I am. With you being probably the only exception I can think of, I much rather prefer to see Picard in red and four pips on his collar.
Again, I go on record as totally disagreeing with you.
I do want to mention that you do have a blue windscreen on your microphone. Our listeners can't see that, but I think that is a nod to blue.
Life is too short for boring colors, so there you go.
But you know, I do find it fascinating that while Star Trek makes a strong case for determinism, it also argues for personal agency. In the end, I think as a whole, the Star Trek universe is really much like our own. While the evidence is apparent that there are causal factors at play that often determine our circumstances, it's difficult, really, Zachary, to think of our human existence apart from the freedom to choose. In the original series episode, What Little Girls Are Made Of, Dr. Brown is talking to Christine Chapel about the teachings of Dr. Corby, and he asks her if she remembers this point, and he says, freedom of movement and choice produce the human spirit. And I think at the end of the day, that really captures my thoughts best.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you're fundamentally a compatibilist. You mentioned that you often have to be reminded that your what seems like your worst choices end up being something that's really in your own best interest in the long run, and you have to learn to embrace that. And that sounds a lot like compatibilism, right? Embracing the trajectory that you're on is compatibilism, right? You can't do anything about what came before. You can't do anything about choices you made in the past, but you can learn the lessons and you can move forward and you can learn to view that as part of your own life story. And to me, that sounds a lot like compatibilism. So
yeah,
it sounds like at the end of the day, you and I are both compatibilists.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about free will and Star Trek today, but free will isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And they've added something completely new and fun. I don't think anybody would have ever thought, you know, before this, you can't fix perfect. Mm. Well, I don't know, but I'd say that they made it more perfect.
Earl Grey.
Daddy, do pets have a Nexus too?
The Pexus.
Kirk had a dog in the Nexus too, didn't he?
Oh,
Butler.
Butler is now Shadow. So we have the adventures homeward bound of Butler, Porthos, and Spot. Will they make it back to their owners in Montana?
The Orb.
If he had like a game card, his power, you know, like, would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning, and then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The Ready Room.
Someone pointed out that this is actually the shortest title of any Star Trek episode. It's shorter than Voyager's Q squared by half a character because the two is superscript.
We're number one. We're number one.
To the journey! It's fake intimacy.
Thank you.
It is them trying to say Chakotay knows Janeway so well that just by fiddling her comm badge, he knows the crap's gonna hit the fan. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Here's a quick question. Is the Blu-ray the correct aspect ratio?
The aspect ratio, you've opened up a can of worms, okay? I'm just telling you right now.
I know that I have, but the thing is, it's because of you that I even cared.
Okay.
The 602 Club.
I think you've hit something here, and I've never thought of it this way, but the true savior of the galaxy, it's not Obi-Wan, it's not Luke Skywalker, it's Aunt Beru.
Literary Treks.
Reagan's a great guy to bring up because his dad was this raging drunk, and you know, he had to sort of drag him in on off the porch at night because he'd come home like falling down drunk, and you know, you think of, and here he was, this kind of great man for the country at the time, but he came from a place that was really kind of dark and also very relatable.
Women at Warp.
Infinite diversity and infinite combinations, even though it's not necessarily always realized that we're looking at it through the lens of our time. But that ideal is there, and striving to be better and to be more inclusive is such a noble goal.
And introducing Meta Trex.
For Odo, the instincts are so powerful, they sort of override every other factor, every other value, every other choice that he has. And I think that's the point of this view of determinism, that all actions that look like they're freely chosen are really just instinctive behaviors of one, in one variety or another.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us to give us feedback on today's show, you can contact us at trek.fm/contact. There's a contact form you can fill out there. You can also leave us an old-fashioned voicemail. Actually, it's a new-fashioned voicemail. It's space voicemail, future voicemail. Go to the Trek FM website and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm to leave us a voicemail. You can find us via Trek FM's Twitter page. That's at Trek FM. Well, if you'd like to contact us with any feedback or suggestions on the show, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact, and there's a form you can fill out there that will come right to us. You can also leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on our show page on Trek FM's website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us an old-fashioned voicemail. It's not old-fashioned voicemail. It's space voicemail, future voicemail. You can also contact us on Twitter under the username @TrekFM, and you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And finally, I want to give a plug for Trek FM's listener group, the Babel Conference. Just go to Facebook and go to the search bar and type Babel into the search field. That's B-A-B-E-L, and it'll come right up. And the Babel Conference is Trek FM's exclusive listener group. It's a closed group, so it's only Trek FM listeners there. So the discussions that happen there tend to be extremely respectful and engaging. You're talking to other Trek FM listeners. And if you want to join in the discussion and comment on anything we talked about today, or comment on anything you heard on any other Trek FM show, that's an excellent place to do it. And we'd be happy to join you in the discussion there. And again, when we're talking about Star Trek and philosophy on MetaTreks, these are open conversations. We want you to join the conversation with us. So we hope you find us on the Babel Conference and join the discussion, and welcome to the team there. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. This is really important. It's one of the most important things you can do to help us out as we're starting a new show here on Trek FM. Ratings and reviews help us place well in iTunes search results. So if you take a little bit of time, and if you're an Apple user, if you just leave us a quick review and leave us a rating, we'd appreciate that. And we'd love to hear any feedback and suggestions you have for the show, especially if there's anything you'd like us to cover in future episodes. All of that is great material to leave in a rating and a review for us. So we hope you take the time to do that if you're enjoying what we're bringing to the network here for you today. Well, Mike, we're going to wrap up the show here in a minute, but before we do that, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you on the internet?
Absolutely. You can find me on Facebook, of course, in the Babel Conference. Again, want to invite you to join in the conversation there. Again, it's a closed group. Ask to join. We'll let you right in. You can also find me on Twitter under the username at cmichael1701. And Zachary, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, likewise, you can find me and all the other Trek FM hosts on the Babel Conference user group. Again, just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search bar and you'll find the Babel Conference. But you can also find me on Twitter, and my handle there is just my name. That's Zachary Fruhling, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y-F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. So Twitter is probably the best place to find me on the interwebs.
Zachary, there's a few people we want to thank before we close the show today. We want to acknowledge C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM. Our executive producers, Sharlyn Smith, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau. Our art director, Aaron Harvey. Will Nguyen, our content manager. Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Dennis Costello, our wonderful editor and producer. So thanks again for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.